The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When Arnie said, "I'll be back," did he mean this many times?
Answer me this, answer me this.
Is spelling Genesis with a Y a linguistic crime?
Answer me this, answer me this. Helen and Ollie, answer me this.
Sometimes we forget that this show has an international audience who may not be fully availed of all of the vernacular that we're deploying.
But we don't forget that there's people listening who might not know what vernacular means.
Anyone can look up vernacular. For instance, we've had this email from Benji who says, "Not being British, I was very lost in Answer Me This episode 317, as I had no idea what a pasty was, other than the bits of material strippers use to cover their nipples."
Yeah, that's how it evolved, Benji. In England, strippers traditionally use lumps of pastry for that, and it just caught on.
Though it wasn't until 1970 they were allowed a lunch break, so they just had to get it where they could.
Benji says, "After performing research, I've determined that a pasty is basically a beef and turnip calzone." They're pretty close, although it's made of pastry rather than dough.
But yeah, it's a sealed pastry containing hot ingredients, Benji, and all those listening who aren't sure what a pasty is. It's usually meat and veg.
Sometimes it's cheese and onion.
Sometimes cheese. It's British fast food, basically, isn't it? It's street food.
It was an old working food because it was a single lunch object that you could take to your job and then eat it while you were still down the mine shaft or whatever, and you didn't have to have cutlery or anything.
Hello, Helen, Ollie and Martin. This is Chrissy calling from Telford. I'm actually calling on behalf of my husband, who always had loads of random questions and never called to answer me this. This week, the question that's been troubling him more than usual is, why doesn't Noel Edmonds, beloved entertainer from Noel's House Party and Deal or No Deal, have more Twitter followers? He's only got 4,000, which doesn't seem like a lot.
It is an intriguing point because, you know, Noel Edmonds used to be one of the absolute biggest stars on British television. I mean, probably the biggest, along with Cilla Black.
Also, you'd think loads of people would just follow him because they watched him 20 years ago.
And the point is, he's still on Channel 4 every day. It's not like he's just a faded star.
Deal or No Deal's still going.
So I was thinking, why is this the case? Why are people not keen to follow Noel Edmonds?
He needs more laughs. See, Paul Daniels has quite a lot of funny tweets. Noel Edmonds, just a bit bland, isn't it?
Well, it's also just got that edge of quackery that most of his modern-day pronouncements have. Mm. So, for example, you look at his biog on Twitter, car mad broadcaster.
What?
I mean, no point fishing for that job, mate. Chris Evans got it.
Well, he could just get rid of car.
Indeed. Then writer. And of what? You know, I mean, he may have written a book, but that's not what he's known for.
He's very prolific post-it note leaver.
Health detective.
What? Oh, no.
Eh?
Is that a TV show, Jibs?
No, I think that's relating to the book that he's written. Which is, you know, some of this new age stuff that he's into.
Right.
Which is fair enough, but again, even if you were looking for someone who was a practitioner of that stuff, I'm not sure the phrase health detective means anything. I think he's invented it. And then positivity guru.
Oh, no.
Mm. I mean, we did know about that, but again, I don't think that's what most people are thinking when they think Noel Edmonds. You know, they're thinking Noel's House Party, they're thinking Deal or No Deal, they're thinking, here is one of the few broadcasters from Radio 1 in the 70s that apparently it's okay to still like.
Do you think it is partly because the Noel Edmonds fan average age might be rather older than that of the average Twitter user?
Yeah, partly that. And I think that partly explains as well why fellow entertainers from the 80s who were at their peak back then have not actually as small numbers as Noel. But I was looking, for example, Sally Jesse Raphael.
But what was it she did?
She was like Oprah, but white.
Right.
She had big glasses, didn't she? Like
had big
glasses.
Red glasses. She talked sense to people that were going through emotional dilemmas in the pre-Springer era.
She was like a Brewster Ricky Lake.
Yeah. Only 20,000 followers on Twitter.
Really?
Michael Barrymore, 31,000 at the time of recording.
Wow.
Again, you know, I mean, I know he's been through his troubles. You'd think that in a way that would make him more compelling on social media, but no, 31,000.
How many has Tiffany got?
What's the possible relation between Tiffany and Noel Edmonds?
Well, I mean, she was like a one-hit wonder, wasn't she? And I had quite an affinity for her because she lived in Cannock for a little while. But I just think, like, someone who's had a sustained TV career should have a bigger follower than someone that really just had a couple of songs.
Okay, would you guess that she has more or less than Michael Barrymore?
I'm going to guess Fewer than Barrymore.
It is fewer than Barrymore.
About 25k?
I'm going to guess 8,000.
Martin's closer. Oh. It's 23,900.
That's respectable. Mm.
I think that's pretty good, actually. She's doing an 80s cruise, apparently.
Of course she is.
At the moment.
She's probably only in her early 40s, isn't she? She's yeah. got at least a couple more careers ahead.
She's looking pretty good in the twit pick.
I follow her. You don't have to show me.
Oh, okay.
I see her pop up on my feed regularly.
This is a game that Ollie and I sometimes play. We'll name a member of an expired boy band.
And then play your cards right, basically.
How many Twitter followers they have.
It's a good game.
It is a good game.
Good game.
But often quite sobering.
Okay, Edward Furlong.
Oh.
Fewer or more than Tiffany?
Fewer.
Edward Furlong
from Terminator 2. Yes.
He must have 50 or 60,000 followers.
Okay, so pick a number.
2,000.
55.
Helen's closer.
What?
6,000.
Oh.
What?
6,000. And actually, his Twitter feed is a bit depressing.
He's not been well.
No, it is a lot of really? Like, oh, I've got writer's block today. Oh, would you like to see me talk about this? It's just all a bit desperate and needy and sad.
Oh, that's a shame.
You see, now, he's not doing anything wrong in terms of the biog. Says very clearly what he's known for. Lifted from obscurity by JC to star along Arnold and Ed Norton. Mm. Now, thinking about it, he means James Cameron, but he's deliberately employed an acronym there that could suggest Jesus Christ.
Well, of course. What's your point?
I think...
It could be a word limit issue.
It could be. I just think the phrasing, it just makes you think, oh, something's a bit weird here.
I think he's just trying to do a joke, but a lot of people are not good at jokes in 140 characters.
No, exactly. And it's often that, isn't it? If you do have a skill with jokes, you'll get more followers. I mean, Noel's mullet on Twitter has 1,200 followers.
And he doesn't even really have a mullet anymore.
No, exactly. I mean, that is his hair from the 80s, having a quarter as many followers as the man himself.
Hey, it's Pitt from Bristol. Is Juliet's balcony in Italy actually Juliet's balcony? And did Shakespeare even go? Because I don't actually believe that he was ever there.
Oh, Pip, you truther.
Where is it? I didn't
Verona.
Know. Okay. All right. So, as in two gentlemen of, you know, yeah. the hints would suggest that Shakespeare had visited.
Well, there
we don't know if Shakespeare was real, really. So, I mean, actually, you know, you go into a whole quagmire, don't you, when you start talking about...
Yeah, they wrote all of Shakespeare's plays in the 70s using an algorithm.
I heard that they were actually all written by Dave Grohl.
I heard it was Gary Barlow.
But anyway, did Shakespeare ever go to Italy at all?
There is no evidence saying that he did. So he could have, because the theatre companies that he was associated with, some of them went on tours of Europe, but they don't have evidence that he did. However, Italian culture and stuff was very fashionable in Britain at the time, so there would have been a lot of sources from which to draw. Mm.
And that's where Romeo and Juliet comes from, isn't it? That's why other people wrote their version of that story, because it was a popular Italian story.
Yeah, they were all nicking from the same source material, weren't they?
Yeah.
I have been to Juliet's balcony on a school trip in 1992.
Is it on a residential building?
It's on a 13th or 14th century building.
Okay.
However, uh-huh. the balcony was added in the 1930s.
Bullshit!
I don't think Juliet was standing on it, pining for Romeo. I think a lot of tourists went to Verona because they loved Romeo and Juliet. And Verona had the same thought that King's Cross has had by putting in the platform 9 3/4 trolley for people to pose by. Yeah. And they were like, okay, well, Juliet was in the Capulet family. There's a house that belonged to the Dal Capello family, which sounds a bit like Capulet. So they bought that house off them in 1905 and declared it to have been the Capulet family residence and created a tourist sensation. And then they added lots of, like, gothic oldie-looking bits to the building that weren't really genuine.
I mean, if it was an American story, the Americans would actually have then an actress dressed up as Juliet that you could have your picture taken with.
Well, they do have a statue of Juliet that is also 20th century, and the legend is that you get good luck if you touch her boob, so one of her boobs is really shiny.
One of her boobs is really shiny?
Yeah, what if
what's wrong with the other one?
Yeah. The other one is not lucky. The other one means that all of your letters will go astray with tragic consequences. There's also Juliet's tomb, but I think that was because he named a particular chapel where they were supposed to meet, and that chapel does exist, and it's very small, so the number of tomb options is limited, and the one that was big enough for someone to, spoiler, kill themselves on is one. So people go to that too. But it's kind of meaningless.
And also, really, when Shakespeare was setting stories in Italy... I mean, there were two reasons he was doing it. One was because it was fashionable and because people liked Italy, and as you say, because the source material was Italian, and so that's why you end up with Two Gentlemen of Verona and Twelfth Night and Merchant of Venice and whatever. But the second reason, I think, is distancing the political realities of the comment he was making from Britain. So, you know, very often he's talking to a British audience about British society, but it's a parallel. It's not a description. So they feel more comfortable. They completely understand that it's a comment on whatever it may be.
Oh, was it like Catholicism and Protestantism?
Well, exactly. Romeo and Juliet can be any racial
divided society.
Yeah. The Merchant of Venice could be about anti-Semitism in Britain, couldn't it? But it's not. It's about Italy, so it's that little bit easier to digest, isn't it?
And he set plays in Scotland and Denmark as well.
Yeah, but why set Hamlet in Denmark, though? It's not a particularly Danish piece.
No, well, we now know...
They don't wear the jumpers.
we now know that it isn't, but that's the thing. To an English audience in 1600, I presume that Denmark was as exotic as setting a movie in space now. So it's just escapism as well, isn't it?
I guess also, he set six plays in Italy, and I wonder whether part of that is because there was this rich theatrical tradition already in Italy that was drawing on all the Commedia dell'arte and stuff like that.
Yeah. All of the above, I think. But that doesn't mean he ever went to a house and pointed up and said, right, I'm going to set a play here and it's going to be on this balcony and in the future tourists will pay to be here and touch her boob.
And I think that's all right. I think it's fine that a lot of writers have not been to the places they're writing about. The world of pure imagination. Here is a question from Zed, who says, I work in a costume hire shop. Today a customer came in saying she wanted a Cinderella costume. I took her to the big fluffy gown section and she said, yes, these are good, but it needs to be blue. Ollie, answer me this. Since when was Cinderella's dress blue? Please tell me that it was specified in the book that she had a blue dress.
What, the book. The Cinderella book.
The one source. Otherwise, I'll be forced to conclude that some film, it's just some film, was made in which she was portrayed with a blue dress and all of a sudden everyone's imagination shut down.
I actually haven't seen Disney's Cinderella. It is a gap in my Disney knowledge.
You immediately leap to Disney.
when there are so many other classic Cinderella films. Even I know it is the film. It is the canonical depiction of Cinderella in the 20th century. It's not just any film. It's not just some film. Hmm. It is understandable that particularly little girls might want to emulate the Cinderella they've seen on screen. Yeah.
Well, even in the Kenneth Branagh live-action film, they made the dress a huge, puffy, blue dress.
Yes. However.
However.
If you actually look at the original film, her dress isn't blue. It is a kind of very light, pastel-shaded bluey-white. Kind of like these trousers that I'm wearing, this kind of summer shade.
People can't see that, but that's still blue.
I know people can't see it. I'm saying it for your reference.
So like an ice blue rather than a sky blue.
When Disney released the DVD in the 1990s of Cinderella for the first time. They looked at the cover art and remastered it. Because you remember, when DVDs came out, it was all a case of buy all the same old films again because they've been digitally remastered. So they redid the cover art on all of the boxes so that it looked like a new film.
Did they make her wear cargo pants and skunk stripes in her hair?
Well, to make it look a little bit crisper, basically, they updated the cover art. She was wearing the white gown, the bluey white gown in the original artwork for the film. But then when the DVD came out, because there's this kind of magic pixie detritus all around her to indicate that the fairy godmother has waved a wand.
Or she's got dandruff.
Or either, in the shape of stars. All down her dress. They decided that if you made the dress blue, then that would show up the stars a little bit more clearly.
That does work.
So that was the decision. And then the other thing that happened around the turn of the century was
the
this...
turn of the 20th to 21st century,
correct,
right,
was the creation of the Disney princesses merchandising brand, which, you know, if you have daughters, you will know is quite a big deal. And essentially that was a way of trying to revivify the corpses of Cinderella and Snow White by teaming them up with...
Snow White, they already revivified when he knocked the apple out of her mouth.
By teaming them up in the same branding family as Jasmine and Ariel and the rest.
I thought it was just a totally organic decision, not based on marketing.
And when you look at the Disney princess family, in other words, if your little girl wants to collect all of the dolls, all of the outfits, all of the duvets or whatever it is, they all have their own colours. So very clearly, Belle from Beauty and the Beast is yellow, Jasmine is turquoise, and so on and so forth. And so, it seems like Cinderella has become blue. She's the blue one in the Disney princess.
So it's a very recent turn of events.
Well, it's a combination of those things, but yes, it's all in the last 30 years. If you watch the original film, it's the only time she actually wears clearly blue is actually in the opening scene when she's in her nightdress.
Oh, right. So it's not just that the blue of the gown has faded from the original print because blue pigment often fades before the other colours.
No. Not as far as I can see. But in any case, bearing in mind that most people think, even if it's revisionism, that Cinderella in Disney Cinderella wears blue to the ball, I think it is explicable that people going to a costume hire shop, people who can't be bothered to make their own costume or find a costume in a place that isn't called costume hire shop, I think it is explicable that those people would be requesting the blue they think Cinderella wears in the film. What's wrong with that?
Well, it's because also, if they're going to a costume party as Cinderella in a dress they bought, they want people to know that it's Cinderella and not just a dress that they're pretending is Cinderella's dress.
Yeah.
Right? But then it'd be easier if they went as Cinderella at the beginning, wouldn't it? Where she was wearing rags and soot and stuff.
Yeah, but again, I sort of understand why people might not want to be walking down the street catching the night bus effectively blacked up and wearing rags.
Yeah, but I think that would be more like modern day living than a huge puffy crinoline.
If you've got a question, then email your question to answer me this podcast at googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast at googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast at googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast at googlemail.com.
Here's a question from Alex, who says, when you hear a report on the news about someone's terrible traumatic experience, or if they're whistleblowing, they often say something on the news along the lines of, to protect this person's identity, their words are being read by an actor. But, Helen, answer me this. Do they ever actually use an actor, or is it just some poor intern dragged in and forced to read it out? Because if it is an actual actor, they don't ever seem to be putting much effort into this, thus wasting their opportunity on national TV to get their talent noticed.
Not necessarily the time or the place, if they're playing a victim of a horrible crime, say.
Yes. Plus, surely this is unnecessary added expense for the show.
They may sometimes have an actor, but what I have definitely seen happen and heard happen is the producer reading out stuff. So we used to be on a show on BBC Five Live where often the producer Ravi would be called upon to read in solemn tones a witness statement or something like that. And I'd be like, ah, it's Ravi!
Yeah.
And also, listening.
Definitely. And it's really funny when you recognise their voice. I've had this as well with the managing director of Sky News, who gave us both work experience circa 2001.
Yes.
He has quite a distinctive northern accent. I've heard him voice President Ahmadinejad before, and that's a good laugh.
Wow, is that him?
Yeah.
Wow.
Not in every address, just sometimes. But, you know,
good job, Peter.
When you recognise the voices, it is amusing. But of course, the audience at home hopefully won't make the connection. It would be embarrassing if they were like, hold on, so the person who was in the earthquake in Hull last week is now the Prime Minister of Turkey. How did that happen?
Upwardly mobile society. I think also you don't want an actor to be using it like an audition piece and doing the full Olivier on news.
No, although of course they do actually sometimes use actors. They do is the answer. Because as Alex suggests, when it's a traumatic experience, when it's a long-form interview, not just 10 seconds of Francois Hollande saying we agree to this deal, but when it's actually going to be a 10-minute long interview on Panorama of someone talking about when they're abused as a child or something like that, obviously you do want a professional actor there because you want it to sound like someone who is as sensitive and fragile as the real person being interviewed. You want to have an emotional connection with the audience. It is better to have an actor. The whole point of good acting in that scenario is that you don't notice they're acting. You would notice it if it was someone who wasn't a trained actor doing that voice for 10 minutes. You would notice it if that was the producer. And of course, occasionally you get examples, don't you? Jerry Adams was the famous one where someone gets employed regularly to be their voice on the news.
Here is another question of behind the scenes at entertainment from Jennifer in Cheshire, who says, Ollie, answer me this. Do people actually ever drink the drinks on daytime chat shows?
Are you suggesting that they're spiked? Are you suggesting that Phil Vickery goes around wanking in them all? Is that the problem?
Yeah, even on channels he's not on. Is there even tea in those mugs? I thought, Ollie, as you had experience, you might be able to tell us.
I do have experience
both
of daytime television.
Backstage and on stage.
Yes. You just completely hyped up my role in the style of a Victorian ringmaster.
Star of screen and screen.
All I can say is, from recent personal experience, when you do Lorraine, it is 8:30 in the morning when you're sitting there on set.
So you don't want the triple vodka.
So exactly. Of course those mugs have tea and coffee in them. I mean, why wouldn't they? It's 8:30 in the morning. They want to give you a caffeine hit.
And they want a little thing with the name of the show on.
Yes. So what happens actually is when you are in the green room, the runner will come and ask you if you want a tea or coffee. It's on the house. It's on the house. Although if you try and be nice about it, and as you know, sometimes I'm actually almost disarmingly trying to be nice.
Really?
You know, I'm like, oh, I can look after myself, like trying to be nice to it. But then,
then like a rake hits you in the face or something.
Well, exactly. So I then go and queue at the coffee bar, and then I get to the front, and then they say, yeah, you're not production, you can't get coffee. So then I have to go back in the green room and ask a runner to bring it to me.
You haven't got the lanyard.
When someone brings you the coffee that you want, they bring it to you in a paper cup. So that doesn't look very good on telly. So what happens is, as you get on set, the floor manager decants your coffee that you're still carrying into a Lorraine mug.
Oh, God, I hope it's pre-warmed.
Even if you were a diva about that, you'd be all right, because, of course, the heat of the studio lights means it does stay hot.
Or at least blood heat.
I actually was experimenting for a long time, because I used to do the paper review on Lorraine once a week. They don't do it anymore. But when I was on it every week, I was experimenting with whether it made me look relaxed or whether it made me look like I thought I owned the place if I was actually sipping from the coffee during the item.
Yeah, and wearing your dressing gown.
Yeah.
Legs apart.
Exactly. Because on the one hand, it does send out a signal that you're very comfortable, which is, you know, part of the skill of being on telly, obviously, is to look like you're not on edge. But equally, there's just something a bit like, it's her show. I'm sitting there with a mug with her name on it, drinking. Yeah.
But also,
just looks wrong.
Whilst you're talking, rain. When you're going, well, this tragic news event.
Exactly. And also, of course, you've only got about 4 minutes. So you don't really want to be taking even 3 seconds to take a sip.
And presumably they use mugs rather than glasses because continuity, you want the level of the liquid to be somewhat invisible. But also you do need the liquid there because when you're on mic, the sound of your mouth gets amplified, and I hate this. I hate being able to hear it on my own work and other people's, you know, that when you're speaking, but I can't find a way to eliminate it on my own tracks. So you need to take regular sips of a drink just to minimise that.
Yes, that's right. Although not if you're doing your own mixing desk, as I learnt to my cost at LBC, costing the organisation £3,000 last year when I managed to, at 3 a.m, spill an entire pint of water all over the mixing desk.
I am amazed that that doesn't happen more often in the middle of the night.
I think secretly it happens quite a lot, but they made it sound like it didn't happen very often.
They should get you one of those hamster bottles and strap it to the mic stand.
Well, the thing is, apparently in the old days, if you spilt a glass of water over a radio mixing desk, obviously if it caught fire, that wouldn't be good. But if it didn't immediately break, then the water would just drip out the bottom and it would be okay.
Oh, analog.
Mm. But now they've got these digital mixing desks that, of course, look like the old analog mixing desks with faders and sliders. But actually, it's a computer in there. So, of course, it's completely fucked as soon as you get any water on it at all.
Balls.
An example of how things have got worse.
We've had this email about classic entertainment from Catherine from Glasgow, who says, I recently got a waterproof MP3 player to keep me amused while I go swimming. Naturally, I throw on a lot of old Answer Me This episodes, vintage ones.
Oh, of course. It's well known, isn't it, for motivating people through exercise, isn't it, or early work.
I'm surprised that MP3 players don't come with those preloaded. I was swimming along, listening to episode 20, feeling nostalgic at all the old jingles, when Occupation Interrogation came on.
Wow.
That is a deep cut.
Blast from the past. Our long-running series of, I think,
three?
It was a sketch, you could call it.
Don't tell them what it is, because people who haven't heard the old episodes yet, they're available at answermethisstore.com, you want them to have the surprise. Like when Martin got into a bath that he had laced with too much menthol. That kind of surprise. You think you know what you're getting.
Yeah.
Catherine says, Ollie, answer me this. Will it ever make a return? I couldn't stop myself from laughing and choked on a load of pool water. It was that good. Yeah, something we haven't done for nearly 300 episodes is probably time to bring that back, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's unlikely it'll make a return. But hey, TFI Fridays come back. You never know.
True.
You never know. It might be when the 20th anniversary of Occupation Interrogation comes around. We'll all think that it was worth it just for the theme tune.
I wonder whether it's a bit of a surprise for people who do buy those episodes when they hear... I think the show is pretty similar in format to when it began, but we do try experimenting in the first few months, particularly just throwing a lot of shit at the wall and seeing what leaves a mark.
And we sound younger as well.
Yeah.
We sound notably younger. It's a bit like looking through your own family photo album if you're a regular fan of the show. It's a bit like looking at us as toddlers, like Muppet Babies, but for me this.
Also, in the early days, we used to have every few months a day when we would get all of our musical and performing friends around and make them do jingles for us and then also get them to do the other features that are sadly no longer with us. And that hasn't happened for years and years.
Yeah, well, regular features are a pain in the ass, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, that's why Gavin Osborne's not here every year doing a song with all
also,
our favourite questions.
It's because the first 2 years when he summarised the years worth of Answer Me This in a song.
Brilliant. I forgot
they are
this.
Brilliant. Yeah. But first 2 years he lived in Crystal Palace, 15-minute walk away. Then he moved to Bath. So, not as convenient.
Do you remember we had that feature where we'd pull together all of the Google hits we'd got on the blog that people had found on
this? Oh, yeah,
we did that quite
well.
There was a little tune that
That's
went
a
with
really
it.
Good jingle for that.
Yeah, the Quickfire Quickle Quiz, remember that?
So many misguided features.
Yes. If you want to take an unaccompanied jaunt down memory lane with our old episodes, they are available at answermethisstore.com. And today's intermission is from episode 61. And I think you should be relieved that what you're about to hear did not become a regular feature in the show. new hot young questionnaire.
Oh, yes.
Warwick, who is 14 and from Enniskillen.
Is that in Northern Ireland?
Could be.
Hello, Warwick. That's my accent.
Oh, good God.
Oh, my God.
Let's say other places Warwick might be from. Warwick is from...
Warwick?
Hello, Warwick.
Warwick is from Aberdeen, Ollie.
Hello. Huh? That's pretty good.
Warwick is from Southern France.
Bonjour, Warwick. I can play this all day, Helen. I'll always have the upper hand.
Oh, of course. Warwick is from Japan.
Oh, I can't do it. God.
Here's a question from Pete in Southampton, who says, there is a pub in Winchester, the Royal Oak, which claims to be the oldest pub in Britain. There is another in Nottingham, Ye Old Trip to Jerusalem, which claims the same thing.
Yeah, they only sell kosher wine there.
And there's yet another in St Albans, Ye Old Fighting Cocks, which is recognised by Guinness as the real oldest pub, but that is disputed by many people.
It's also been in the news recently due to a campaign to rechristen it Ye Olde Clever Cocks to reflect compassion for animals.
There are seemingly lots of other pubs around the country which claim to be the oldest pub, but surely it would be a simple thing to identify which is really the oldest pub.
Oh, surely.
So, Ollie, answer me this simple thing.
Yeah.
Which pub is really the oldest pub in Britain?
Well, guess what? It isn't simple.
You can't.
So there, yeah. Drink that.
Isn't the history of a public house? It's just a house where people drank in.
Well, the issue is, and I refer you to the BuzzFeed article, 11 pubs that might be the oldest in the UK.
11!
It isn't a simple thing to date them, because it could be that you're dating it from the moment it became a pub as we know it now. It could be that you're dating it from the moment it became a brewery.
Mm.
It could be that you're dating it from the moment that a pub stood on the site where it literally is now, or a pub with the name that that one has now. There are so many things that it could be. It might have been a hostelry before.
Yeah, or coffee house or something.
It might have been
like
a
that.
Private drinking establishment. How do you possibly date it? I'm afraid, actually, that I am going to go with the Guinness one, which is Ye Old Fighting Cocks, because they've
funny
done,
name.
They've done more research than anyone else, and they've applied the criteria that they have. It was founded in 800.
Wow.
But it's only had that name since 1872,
mm-hmm.
and it's only been on that location since 1539. So it's still not actually that old when you think that, you know, Brits like to drink and have done for centuries.
So when you say it was founded in 800, does that mean, what, there was just a barrow there or something?
Yeah, it means... A pub, which later became Ye Old Fighting Cocks, was on a similar site in St Albans since 800.
But I think the licensing laws came in fairly late, didn't they? And a pub was just, I'm going to let people drink in my living room, but I won't brew the beer myself, I'll get someone else to brew the beer.
Yes. So the living room thing is interesting because that's where the Jerusalem one that he mentions in Nottingham comes in.
The Old Trip to Jerusalem. That's a very cumbersome name for a pub.
It is. It's, in the foundations of the castle, or what used to be the castle. Mm.
It's like when people have bars in their basement now.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
If you include private establishments before they became public-facing pubs, then that's the argument for that one, because when they actually did an excavation into the foundations of the castle there in the 1970s, there were suggestions that the caves below the pub had belonged to the castle's brew house in the 12th century.
Right.
So, theoretically, drinking has been happening exactly in that site since the 12th century, but it was private drinking.
And probably
drinking.
Before.
And probably before, because people like to drink.
Yeah.
But it was private drinking, it wasn't public drinking. So, you know, does that count or not?
Also, weren't a lot of monasteries, didn't they have, like,
oh, they love it.
Distilleries and
yeah,
stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I heard this theory that alcohol co-evolved with human beings because the fermentation process made things easier to digest. So there's an argument that bread co-evolved with human beings, but there's also an argument that alcohol was actually the real thing that followed humankind through its process of civilization. So actually, like, the first pubs are probably like 10,000 years old, but they don't have a license, and they're not a Wetherspoons name.
Yeah, and also, I mean, drinking has always been actually associated with the church, hasn't it, to some extent? Because you have celebrations, and then also you...
free communion wine.
Bit of a communion wine. So actually, you could say every church in Britain is an older pub than the pubs.
Yeah.
Can I just say as well, to anybody who's already sharpening their pencils to write us an email about ye... in these things being pronounced the, I know, but I just said ye because you all know what we're talking about.
I didn't know.
When the printing presses came and they got rid of the old English letter th, they replaced it with y. And so the ye is actually supposed to be pronounced the. And the oldie with an e, that was just to justify the sentence rather than to be pronounced oldie.
Okay, but those people, and I'm glad you addressed them directly because they're your people, those people are pedants, aren't they?
Yes.
Because as we often debate when it comes to anything linguistic in this way, surely most people seeing that sign in St Albans now would say Ye Old Fighting Cock, so that is what it's called.
Yeah, Ye
Oldie. It's
not
called Ye Oldie, it's called Ye Oldie. I think my favourite of all the old pubs that are vying for the title, all the oldie pubs, is probably the Skirrid Mountain Inn in Abergavenny.
Skirrid.
Oh. Because their first floor was once used as a courtroom with hangings carried out from an oak beam above the staircase. Ooh. And they still have a noose.
Do they
still have a noose on the beam?
They should have a pinata on it, though.
If you get to the Prospect of Whitby and Wapping, they've still got a noose outside the pub.
Do they?
Yeah.
What the fuck is wrong with these people? Right. Alcohol is a depressant. Why on earth would you celebrate the history of the establishment that used to hang people? I mean, it just has to go wrong once, doesn't it? Mm. One stag party has to go wrong once, and that's on your conscience forever.
Hey, look at me. I'm a 15th century dead man. Well... Why are all Yao's fan sites just about one thing? The only way is up is not the only song she sings. What about Abandon Me? One true woman or good thing going? Her single from 96.
You should make your own Yao's site to fill in the gaps. Since you seem to think all the current Yao's sites are crap, go to squarespace.com, build your Yao's site, and put Yao's back on the map.
The only way is up.
Thank you, Squarespace, for sponsoring this episode of Answer Me This.
Very good of you. And thank you also for making it so easy to design websites. I've been using it for theallusionist.org, and it's a real piece of piss.
It is.
And also, I'm sure that's their slogan.
Yep.
Squarespace, it's a piece of piss.
Yeah, sure.
That's a compliment, Squarespace, in case that didn't translate to your American ears.
I can't imagine Ira Glass saying it, but I imagine on this show...
That's why we're better.
Exactly.
The VW handles like a piece of piss.
No, but it's very easy. You make changes to the website without having to use complicated forms, and they show up instantly on your screen.
Yes.
Drag and drop, point and click.
Well, you just change the text on the front of the website.
Oh my
god,
no
messing around with HTML. And also very easy to embed things, which is often a problem with other website things that I have used.
And sell digital products as well. So if you want to sell digital audio, for example, maybe you're not so keen on this whole Apple Music idea, then do what we've done. AnswerMeThisStore.com. You see how we sell our digital files? That's all done through Squarespace. They host it for you, and then you can sell stuff through their templates as well.
It's a real dream.
It is. And remember, you get 10% off if you join Squarespace for a year by using our code...
Answer. Here's a question from Alison, who says, we've just bought our 4-year-old daughter a nifty Bluetooth speaker. She's constantly repeating Bluetooth enabled and forms it into songs, which is getting a touch annoying.
Well, then don't buy a 4-year-old a Bluetooth speaker.
Too late. Pandora's box is open. She knows the phrase Bluetooth enabled and she is sticking with it. She's taking it quite literally, so she checks the mirror to see if her teeth really are blue, like the lady in the speaker says.
Aww.
Lady in the speaker, sinister. So, Ollie, answer me this. Where does Bluetooth come from?
Sweden.
Oh.
Created by Ericsson in 1994.
Ericsson.
As in the phone company, not Sven Göran.
My first mobile phone was an Ericsson.
Was it?
Yeah.
You've got me thinking now. Was mine an Ericsson or a Nokia? Mine was Nokia. I had the banana phone from The Matrix. That was my first one.
Wow.
Oh.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
I had a very large Motorola.
But mine, you press
right
the sides.
No need to boast.
My one didn't have the thing where you press the sides and the thing slid down like Keanu's one. My one, you had to manually pull it down.
Oh, how you suffered!
Yeah. Oh,
did it have a little bit of string on the bottom to tug like a bathroom light fitting?
It was a cool first phone. But anyway, yeah, Ericsson developed the technology in 1994. But weirdly, and in a sense, I think in a very Swedish way, they decided not to own this technology. They formed a special interest group. Yeah, I know.
Wow.
Still be in massive profit if they had. They formed a special interest group with Intel, Nokia, Toshiba and IBM. So no one owned the company. No one owned the technology. And it's as a result of that open sourceness that it took off as the platform that everyone wanted to use. And so the name Bluetooth comes from an allusion to that openness as well, because it comes from the 10th century Danish king Harald Blattand, which translates to Harald Bluetooth in English, wonderfully. And King Blattand was known for uniting warring factions across Scandinavia. So there you go. So it's the equivalent in open source IBM versus Nokia versus Ericsson ways. It's similar to uniting Norway, Sweden and Denmark in warfare.
I love how something as boring as Bluetooth has has thousand-year-old Scandinavian origins. And you know why his nickname was Bluetooth?
I don't.
He was a big fan of eating blueberries and his tooth got stained blue.
Down and lonely, life feels so confusing. I need some answers, preferably amusing. Now I find a podcast that will suit I listen to Helen and Ollie on my half-hour commute.
Time for a question from Matt in Lincolnshire, who says, I'm very happy to say that I've met the love of my life.
Congrats.
And we have three gorgeous children together. Having run out of bedrooms in our house, we've had to draw the line there.
I don't want to have to go to IKEA to buy another bed.
So, says Matt, last August, off I popped to my GP to be snipped. I spent an uncomfortable 45 minutes flat on my back, having my balls fiddled with. I'd always thought that once the tube was snipped, that would be that. No sperm were getting through, and away I went to get my end away. Probably made a big weekend out of it. Right, vasectomy on the Saturday morning whilst the kids are at the grandparents. Let's go for it. But no, says Matt, I had to wait 4 months, ensuring regular servicing of my member throughout.
Yep.
And then provide two samples a month apart to make sure the job was done.
Yep.
I didn't know you had to do that when you have a vasectomy.
Well, I suppose you haven't had one, have you?
I guess, but they do make it seem, and by they, I mean people I know who have had one, and also depictions on Neighbours.
Yeah.
They do seem to make it seem like it's a straightforward process.
How surprising that people you know who've had them done and depictions on Neighbours don't go into medical detail. They just make jokes about how much they hurt.
Yeah, but I wasn't expecting this, though. Matt says, I've now been through this rigmarole 3 times... He's had his balls fiddled with 3 times and had to go through a load of wanking in a jar for a month. 3 times.
The love of your life has given birth 3 times. Stop complaining.
Wait, no, come on. Just because he's not saying it's as bad as that, Helen.
I think he's implying
No. This isn't a feminist issue. You're allowed to feel sympathetic with the man for having painful balls and
3 times.
Being humiliated.
Oh, just have to wank twice a month. Oh.
You can't. Women win every argument if the answer is, well, it's not as bad as giving birth. We know that.
It isn't.
I know.
Although my mum said having gallstones was worse. So she won her own argument.
And that's something men can suffer from as well. So that's,
that is true. Yeah.
People tell
me. Try having gallstones, Matt, once a month.
Having a dislocated shoulder can be as bad as giving birth. And I've had that 3 times.
Yeah, try doing that in your balls.
Anyway, says Matt, I've been through this rigmarole 3 times. And yet now I have a further appointment for a more detailed analysis, including the production of a sample on site, i.e. a wank in a storage cupboard. So 10 months down the line, it would seem my balls are working perfectly and my discomfort was for nothing.
Well, it doesn't necessarily seem that way, Matt. It seems like they're checking.
True, but I mean, if the ratio continues as it has been, you know, if it seems like his balls are resistant to all vasectomy interferences, then it has been for naught.
Well, he doesn't know yet because he's got a further appointment, but he hasn't had it yet.
The law of probability, we're preparing him psychologically for this eventuality.
If he's,
I think that's reasonable.
One of the 1 in 2,000 whose vasectomies don't work.
Is that all it is?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, he says, Helen, answer me this. Where are all these sperms still coming from?
Your balls.
Your balls.
Your balls are still making as many sperms as they were before. It's just now they're not going in the same direction.
They get redigested, I think, sperm that aren't used.
A lot of them build up in the epididymis.
Oh.
The 16-foot-long tightly coiled tube behind each testicle where sperms learn to swim.
So, okay, anecdotally, and by that I do mean personal experience, I know that the longer it's been between sessions, either administered by someone else or by myself, there is a larger discharge.
Yeah, but that's seminal fluid,
yes,
which is not quite the same thing.
Sure. If it's been a month, do you ejaculate like a horse?
Well, you're supposed to ejaculate quite regularly, like he's saying. He is ensuring regular servicing of his member throughout, he specifies.
Yeah.
Because it takes up to 4 months, but I think averagely a couple of months or 15 to 25 ejaculations to ensure that your tubes after the site of the snip are free of sperms, so you're not likely to get someone pregnant. So they have to keep checking his sperms, and it's good that he's going for the appointments, because apparently a lot of men don't get it checked, and that's why the vasectomies fail. They check that he's cleared all the sperms out from lower than where they snipped his vas deferens off, and also that the scar tissue has formed, thus stopping the sperms from continuing to go out of his penis towards an egg. You just need to check that there isn't any sperm in your seminal fluid.
Okay, but when you say you need to check,
I don't need to. You don't need to, Wally.
Sure, but Matt can't self-check that.
Could you not look at it under a microscope?
Probably he could. Probably there's an innovations catalogue product that does just this.
I think it's the kind of thing where just if you didn't know what you were looking for, you could easily be misled by what you saw under a microscope. And also you'd have to ejaculate on that tiny bit of glass.
Yes, I think the point at which you've just wanked onto a microscope, afterwards you'd probably be feeling enough shame that science would go out the window.
Yeah.
I've had worse.
Matt says, even if the vasectomy had all gone to plan, why would it take 4 months to work? And he admits these are questions. I should have probably asked my general practitioner at the time.
Yes, like all the medical questions we get.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, actually, when you're with not just a GP, but actually a surgeon, any medical professional, sometimes...
I'm fine.
Yeah, you're prepared to be guided by them. And also, I think, particularly as an Englishman, you're less likely to question it. You feel like you're being rude by asking questions sometimes. Yeah. Even when I've gone to private health practitioners and they create the impression, because you're paying a lot, that they're giving you all the time in the world, you still feel like you're taking up the time of an intelligent person and they'll tell you anything you need to know.
Some people are really ill.
Exactly.
You're getting in the way.
But that's ridiculous, because everyone should ask these questions, because then you go home and you think, oh, my vasectomy hasn't worked. Why is that?
Do you think that a lot of people agree to have the vasectomy before they really know about the full process? They or their partner has decided that that is what is going to happen to them.
Mm.
And so they don't necessarily know that there's like a 4-month healing period in which you have to use other forms of contraception.
I think that's probably right. Yeah. I suppose distantly in the back of my mind, I've considered that one day I might get a vasectomy.
Just something to do.
But now I'm not convinced because of this. I mean, I'm not someone who objects that much to using barrier contraceptives, but if I was, I'd still probably hear this and think, not sure.
My friend Julie, who is the third child of five, said that her dad went to have one, and he was chatting to a guy in the waiting room who was like, oh, is your first time? He's like, of course it's my first time. He's like, not mine. He'd had several before. And so Julie's dad didn't have one and had two more children.
Oh, because he was put off by that statement.
Yeah, like, what's the point if it's not going to work?
What's the point if it's not going to work? Yeah.
Well, it's time to snip off this show now, but there will be one in 2 weeks' time.
And your questions are our sperm. To send them up our urethra, you can email, call, or Skype them. All the details are on our website.
AnswerMeThisPodcast.com.
And also, in the intervening 2 weeks, don't forget to check out our other work. Ollie is on LBC every weekend.
Every Friday and Saturday night till 10.
And also on the Media Podcast.
And the Tech Weekly Podcast from The Guardian.
And I make The Allusionist, which I think you'll like, listeners, so give it a go.
Yeah, it's about words and stuff. If you like Helen talking about words, you'll probably like that.
Yeah.
And you can listen to the Sound of the Ladies podcast, The Global Lab, and Brain Train, which is a bit out of date, but we'll be having new episodes over the summer, if you'd like to.
There's a promise.
So I think you'll find that is quite a lot to be getting on with for the next fortnight.
That's plenty.
Yes. Just remains for us say thank you very much to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of Answer Me This.
Yes, thank you.
And thank you for listening.
Bye!